Hi, Jamie. How have you been?
I'm doing okay, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Do I sound okay?
You sound fantastic.
It's been so long since we podcasted, I had to hook up my microphone and figure out how to turn it on again.
Sorry, Mike. Me too.
It's not your fault. All right, Jamie, we're here to do Mr. Robot Episode 1, which comes in two parts.
That's correct.
Very confusing to talk about this even. It's like, okay, you want to do one and two? Well, let's just do one. Well, what about the two? One is two parts. Well, I'm not ready for two. Well, you're ready for the second half of one?
Right.
And then they start at zero. So it's 2.0 and 2.1 are in episode one.
Yeah, we're going to do the same number thing that we did last year with this JAG. It's kind of...
I'm not. I'm calling this episode one. It's got two halves to it.
Well, you know what? I think that's just fine.
And the other thing is we're behind. So we talk about episode one and episode two is already broadcast.
Right.
And episode three is only 3 days away.
Well, we will do better. We've just had a rough start.
All right, Jamie, might need some help in this because Mr. Robot is a dense show to cover. And I forgot a bunch of stuff just watching. It's like, oh, who's this guy? What now? What did that person do last year? I didn't do a rewatch of any of season one.
I didn't either. I had grand plans and intentions and then started my new job and got sick and have a lot going on. So I've done some homework, but I haven't done rewatches.
All right. This is season two, episode one, part one. And its nomenclature is in that file coded type of way. EPS 2.0 underscore UNM4SK-PT1.TC.
Right.
So essentially, episode 2.0 unmask, part one.
Right.
And what's TC? Do you know that file extension?
I do actually know that file extension. That is, there are a couple of names for it, but usually it's referring to something called TrueCrypt, which is real-time encryption. It's a program that will allow you to encrypt your volumes, your data, whatever it is that you're trying to send, as you're actually creating it.
Oh, that's what I thought it was. No, just kidding. I had absolutely zero idea what it was. All right, Jamie, let's dive into this. You just help me where you can, and if you can't, I understand, because this is, like, complicated stuff.
All right.
So Terrell's at Mr. This is not only a dense show with like a lot of details, it's like very philosophically dense. Like who's alive, who's real, who's not, who's a part of an imagination, what's being fake, what's being real, who's dead, who's alive. It's tough.
Yeah, there's a lot of that reality, kind of not reality things, a lot of flags and questions in my head as I was watching.
So Terrell's at Mr. Robot's with the mask. And Elliot is finishing up the code that he, I guess he enlisted the Chinese guys last season to start the process with bricking the whole financial system.
Right.
And it's only, it seems like, in that room, in the HQ, it's only Terrell and Elliot in there. And it looks like Elliot murders Terrell with the gun from the popcorn machine after they get it going.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he goes and grabs the whatever's in the popcorn machine, but then nothing.
Yeah, because the whole rest of the episode, Elliot's trying to figure out where Terrell is.
Right.
First of all, is it Tyrell or Terrell?
I think they say both. So I think you and I said both last season. I think it just kind of depends on the flow of whatever the sentence is.
Terrell Willick. Tyrell Willick.
I think it's Tyrell Willick.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Jamie. So now I got a reflection on this whole process of like nixing and bricking the whole financial system.
Uh-huh.
To me, it's a lot like the Black Lives Matter protests on the freeway. You're going to make some people happy by wiping away their debt, but you're going to make a whole shitload of people unhappy with this exercise of protest. You're going to fuck a lot of stuff up, man. People aren't going to have money for food. People aren't going to pay bills. They're going to lose their mortgages. You can't just do this and make everybody happy. You're going to have a lot of angry folks if this was real.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the reality of it. And I think we talked about that a little bit last season. I mean, when you make a decision to crash anything that involves currency or, you know, what people need to get through their day-to-day lives, you're going to create a whole lot of shit. And that's what happened.
Yeah, or blocking a freeway. You're very apparently, you know, all the news goes to you. You get a lot of attention, but you're screwing up a lot of people's going to work and going to maybe a hospital to visit the dying relative. And, you know, all the stories you hear about how they stop people from seeing their mother for the last time. There's a lot of consequences related to it. It's not just a simple act.
That's right.
All right, next we see a flashback of Elliot being thrown out the window. And I guess this is after the news that his father has leukemia. He tried to hug his father and got tossed out the window.
Well, no. That is the flashback to the time that he told his mother. Because remember, his father had asked him to keep the diagnosis a secret. And Elliot, being a child and, you know, sort of being overwhelmed by the fact of his father's illness and his mother being completely in the dark, very understandably confessed to his mom what he knew. And when he did, and then he told his father what he had done, or his father found out what he had done, Elliot asked his dad to forgive him, and his dad responded by pushing him out the window.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for correcting me. And I thought he was like trying to hug him or something. You know, it was too much intimacy for Mr. Robot.
No, I mean, the dad, and then that's the other question, right? Is now that we know so much more about Elliot, did that really happen the way that he remembers it? Or did he just throw himself out the window?
Yeah, I got a bunch of points in this podcast where I'm going to say, did that really happen? Or did that just, is that a version of what happened or a colored memory of what happened?
Exactly.
It's tough. Okay, so they're at the doctor now because he broke his arm and hit his head. His head's okay via the scan, but his forearm is broken. And his mother asks about the costs. By the way, you can think about this, Jamie. I'm going to ask later on in this, is his mother still alive? Because he's interacting with his mother later in this episode.
Now, I don't know because I didn't go back and do any rewatches. I cannot remember. I'm so sorry to our audience, but I don't remember if his mother is dead. I was under the impression that she was dead. So, maybe not, though.
Okay. Well,
no,
so
we actually, you know what, Mike? We don't think she's dead. We know the dad is dead. We don't know what's the situation with the mom. So she could be alive and well. She could be real. Instead of, like, what I'm thinking, which is that she's, you know, a figment of his imagination. She could be real.
Right. So yeah. The mother asks about the costs of the treatment for the broken arm. Like, you don't really have much of a choice here. She's trying to make it, like, a purchase decision, though. Like, I don't know if we want to do this. It might be too expensive. Like, you gotta do it, right?
Well, okay, so he's already been treated. At that point, his arm is in a sling, so he's already all set. It wasn't like a shrewd financial decision she was making. Those are the kinds of lines that are spoken, or like that's the kind of dialogue that happens when a person is really, really, really broke, like they don't have money. Because they let him get treated first, but her next concern after, okay, our kid has, you know, a bleeding head wound. What are we going to do? How do we get him, you know, help? Which we saw in that first scene with him, with the mom and Mr. Robot. And now, you know, her first concern is the financial aspect of it. Because, you know, if they get a bill at the end of this hospital visit, they won't be able to pay it. And that's what she's telling the doctor.
Jamie, do you have the authorities arriving at your house?
Why?
I thought I heard like a siren or one of those robot bomb detonators coming up to your door.
I don't think so, but you know, I should probably close my window because
I'm
right
next. Yeah,
there was
a weird sound, like ooh, like a flying saucer landing or something.
Seriously?
Might have been on my end. All right, so now, interestingly, after Mom asks about what this is all going to cost, Dad says, "I told you there will be no bills." Now, what the hell? How does Dad know that there's going to be no? That's the window to the future of wiping out all the debt, right?
Well, I mean, it kind of sounds like something. There's a weird thing going on there, which makes me wonder because, you know, the first scene of the series where we meet Mr. Robot, you know, he's like sitting up from laying down on the subway seat, and he's looking at Elliot, and he's like, "This is an awesome day to be alive, dude." So, you know, it makes you wonder, like, what? Like, there will be no debt, you know? And this is like at a time when the internet's sort of getting to be a thing, and we know he's a computer guy, and so, you know, maybe that was his dad's plan all along.
Well, or it's Elliot remembering this in present time. He's thinking back about this, and he's putting those words in his dad's mouth.
Maybe.
I don't know. So more mystery. So the doctor now interrogates Elliot, or not interrogates him, but questions him about what happened with the arm. And yeah. I guess it's like parental abuse type questions, right?
That's exactly right. And that's because the mother was not concerned with, okay, so when do we bring him back? What do we give him for pain? You know, that kind of kinds of questions that a mother would ask. She wasn't asking any of those questions. Her first concern was, all right, this is a bill we can't pay. You know, this is her only thing. And so, and we know she's a cold woman. Right?
Yeah.
I think we know that she loves Elliot because she was really, truly like panicked and distraught and, you know, beside herself really when they found him injured. But what kind of a person is she? You know, I don't know.
Jamie, I think we all have Mr. Robot in us. We all have our parental laws and scripts from our childhood that we remember that kind of molded us somewhat into the adults that we became. I think it's super interesting that we probably all have a little bit of our parents, whether they're dead or alive, still in us that make us affect decisions that we make today as adults and change how we act sometimes and steer us a little bit.
Well, okay.
I know I don't see a dead guy sitting across the room from me when I think of my father, but I think that I must have some of his influences still in me that help and hurt and whatever, but they're part of my decision process, I think.
Well, I think that's true. Yeah, I mean, I think that all of the influences that we encounter in our lives growing up, our formative years, kind of you know, replay for us. They kind of are like you know, like background noise in our brains when we make our decisions. So I think, yeah,
it's the nature or nurture argument, probably timeless argument. It won't ever really be solved, but it's an interesting one.
I agree.
All right, we see the Red Wheelbarrow composition book. And the Red Wheelbarrow, I think, comes from this hot Carla girl who's the arsonist, burns books in the wagon, the red wagon.
Yeah, well, okay, so I don't know.
It's not really a wheelbarrow, but it's a little red wagon.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah. And did you see the book in there?
Yeah, Waiting for Godot.
Yeah. Oh, it was interesting. I really kind of, you know, I'll tell you something at this point because, you know, this show is great at Easter eggs. And I really hope that the fact that our audience is all aware now, you know, of kind of, you know, kind of to keep their eyes open and research things and what to look for and that kind of stuff, that we don't lose the specialness of that, you know, of the Easter egg thing. I hope they get more clever with them as the audience gets more clever about the show.
Do you know anything in particular about Waiting for Godot?
Well, you know, I looked it up. I haven't read the book. But I did look it up, and I found a thread on Reddit, of course, where they were discussing it, and they were talking about interpretations of the book, and they said that, you know, some of it is, some people say that it's about the ruling elite, right, that are keeping the working classes passive and ignorant by whatever means, and, you know, there are a lot of philosophers and writers who have addressed that sort of thing, like distracting the masses with things that are interesting, you know.
Yeah, cake. Let them eat cake.
Well, that kind of stuff. And then kind of like the philosophers who talk about people being enslaved not by being held down and forced, but by being distracted by pleasurable things. Not just like, you know, like a quote from somebody, but like I think it's Huxley, Aldous Huxley, who said that was the way that humanity would be enslaved. And it turned out that he's sort of right, at least from this vantage point he is.
Yeah, you mentioned Reddit. It's interesting. Reddit was made for this show, or this show was made for Reddit. It's just theories every left and right. And I've got a couple that I want to talk about when we get to them. But
Okay.
But yeah, Waiting for Godot. And then we see Obama editing. I think that they took some of Obama's speeches and edited them into him being on the news and relating to Mr. Robot's topics here.
Yeah, because I've never heard Obama say anything, you know, like that. And of course, he referred to, you know, something that's currently happening, you know, on a fictional television show. But there, I think it either they ran his voice through something that would pull out, you know, words and then put them in the right order, or they got somebody to impersonate his voice. And I'm not sure which. If I had to guess, I would say it was an impersonator. But he was good. It sounded.
Yeah, they synced the video to some of it, so it wasn't just his audio. It was like him speaking the words. It was pretty clever, however they did it.
Yeah, it was great special effect.
All right, so we see Elliot's routine, and it's basically a routine to maintain sanity. And we meet Leon, his new buddy.
Yeah, like Leon. You know who I thought it was? I thought it was that guy Michael. Somebody, the actor. Do you know who I'm talking about? The guy who was in Fruitvale Station?
I never saw Fruitvale Station.
Okay, so anyway, he's a fantastic actor. Michael something. I can't think of his name right now. But I thought it was him for a second. Whoever that guy is a fantastic actor. I really like him.
So they eat together every day. They watch sports. They talk. And they talk kind of about the chaos behind the order of things. And we hear that again in the basketball game that we're going to see and some other stuff. So it's kind of an interesting discussion he has with this guy, Leon. And his day's worked around this routine to keep Mr. Robot at bay. So then we see some more Obama, scenes of chaos from the thing that they pulled off on the news. And we also find out that Elliot, as Elliot goes to a church group 2 days a week.
Yep, that's right.
And this is all recorded in his journal at what looks like his mom's house. But these things we just spoke about here are all in question because of, basically because of Reddit and theories about what might really be going on. But at his mom's house, there's no internet or computer. So he's free from Mr. Robot that way.
Right.
That's what he presents, and that's what it appears to be. But again, there's a theory coming up here. And he has a boring, comfortable routine, Jamie, just like everybody else. Just like we all kind of find comfort in our days. We don't look for challenges every second. Some of us never look for challenges. We find comfort and live in that comfort, in that routine. And then we see that Elliot is telling all of this to his psychologist or psychiatrist, Krista.
To his therapist, Krista. Yeah, he's having this conversation with her, and then we get the information. We know now that Krista actually did have a reaction to what Elliot did. I guess I don't know if it was the first scene. Or if it was this one, but in one of these scenes, she says to him, a condition of my continuing to talk to you was that you actually do what I ask, you know, when you come in here, that you say things when you come in to visit me. So she actually gave him consequences for doing what he did to her last season.
Yeah, and that was like totally bugging her whole life, stealing her privacy.
Yep.
All right, she asks him, do you feel alone? And he says Darlene comes back sometimes. Now, Jamie, I'm embarrassed to admit, what the hell, where is Darlene? What happened to Darlene in season one?
All right, so Darlene, we don't really get like a huge follow-up with her because I think the last time that we saw Darlene was when she flipped out and was like, what the fuck, Elliot, when he tried to kiss her. And so I don't think that we know very much. And I think it's great, actually, the way that we caught up with her. Because, at the beginning of this episode, it kind of flashed back on a moment that was previous to the last time we saw her. Because, like, let's say that was the last time we saw her last season, was that scene where, you know, she realized that Elliot didn't. Oh, no. The last time we saw her last season, she was with Angela. They were in the cemetery, remember? And they had found Elliot. They'd been looking for him. He was with his dad. And they walked up to him and asked him, like, who were you talking to, Elliot? Because nobody was there. I think that was...
Yeah, I didn't put as much effort into this rewatching season one as I probably should have. So that's foggy for me.
Okay. All right. So, yeah. So, anyway, yeah, Darlene, we don't know, basically, what's going on with her. And so when we actually see her, it's surprising. We don't know if she's excited or, you know, if, because the last time, well, I guess, yeah, the last time we saw her, she was really happy about what had happened. You know, she was like glad that that everything had shut down and they were successful. Excuse me, Mike, I'm sorry.
You all right?
I'm sorry, Mike.
Did you find out your bank account was just wiped out?
Mike, give me a second for real. I gotta get some water. I'm sorry. All right, I'm sorry about that.
It's all right. You okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm just hot. My this cold. I missed like 3 days of work this week because of this cold. It's awful.
Yeah, I hate summer colds.
Oh my God, it's so bad. And I never get sick. So this is like really bad for me. But anyway, so yeah, she was really happy. So we didn't know how to expect to see Darlene. And when the scene opened on her and she was just sitting there looking really messed up, I was surprised and kind of glad, because it means that, you know, sort of the theme of this introductory two episodes, that the writers took it seriously, that, you know, the reality of it is kind of being shown.
Okay, so he kind of ends with Krista by saying, I can't trust myself, and then really, I don't trust him, so he can't trust Mr. Robot.
Yeah, pretty absolutely. Yep.
And then he talks to us, Jamie. He talks to the audience. He says, hello again. He's mad at us because we kept things from him that right. We should have told him. And he's he doesn't want to trust. It's just, I don't know, how do you parse this? He doesn't want to trust us because we didn't tell him what we should have shared with him as an audience.
Yeah, okay, so... Yeah, I kind of liked that a little bit. I thought it was interesting because once again, we find that we are out of sync, you know, with Elliot. We don't really know what he's talking about. And, you know, we're realizing in that moment that it could be that he doesn't. I mean, like all of this, even though it's all made up in his head, it's still kind of an unparsed reality for him because it's, you know, kind of being generated by his messed up mind, you know? So I don't know why he thinks we didn't tell him things. Maybe he thinks that we knew, you know, that stuff wasn't real. And we didn't tell him, you know, I don't know what it is.
It's pretty interesting to be a character in a TV show as an audience though.
It's fantastic.
So he writes about Mr. Robot's presence in his journal. Mr. Robot's in his room, and Mr. Robot shoots him. And somewhere in there, Elliot again wants to know where Terrell is, like Mr. Robot can tell him where Terrell is. And yeah. As he's writing in the journal, blood drops on the pages. The blood has to be imagined because he's not shot in the head, and the journal doesn't have blood in it later. So it's interesting. It's up to us as the audience to keep all these boundaries clear between what's real and what's just imagined by him.
That's right.
All right, somebody cuts the balls off the bull on Wall Street.
Yeah, okay, so that's like Darlene and her cronies. They're all like standing there doing that. I don't know, I guess, you know. that's another one of those things that I guess you do when, you know, when you destroy the world. You know, for all intents and purposes, but you don't really know what to do after you've got what you want, you know?
Well, it's a symbol, too, of pretty clearly cutting the masculinity off of the you know, Wall Street and the economic and corporate financial system of the country and world that's representative of that.
Well, yeah, okay. So, but yeah, but I mean, what does that really mean? It's not an action. It's not a thing that they're doing to have any real effect. That to me is kind of like the bully, you know, shoving, you know, the small kid after he's already beat him up. You know, you've made your point. It's not like there are any more points to be made unless you have some more points.
I think they do, though. I think the point of this is, and they get to it later on, is like the act that they did inspires a lack of confidence in people that causes them to run on the, because they don't really do any. I mean, that money is, they didn't take the money. They just wiped out the records of the money. So it's all like a confidence game. And they talk about this, the con game and the basketball game, even they make references to it. The confidence of FDR making the banks appear solvent back in the 30s and 40s when they really weren't quite ready yet. So it's a confidence in the system that they're trying to wipe out from the public's view. And of course it's symbolic to cut the balls off a statue. Doesn't really mean anything, but it's kind of a symbolic thing, I think.
Okay, so it's symbolic. I agree with you. But I could be wrong. I haven't done a lot of reading about this episode, but the way that I kind of took it is almost like a hangover moment, you know? Like, not that moment of the bull, you know, cutting the balls off of it, but the whole episode is kind of like, okay, so we went out and we just did everything. Like, we partied, you know, we did everything we wanted to do. We got what we wanted. Now what? You know, it's like, what are they going to do now?
Yeah, it's a celebration. It's like toppling over Saddam's statue and to Crete or wherever they were. You know, it's like symbolic of our victory. We're conquerors now. We're celebrating and you lost. But I think that's perceived as like, you shouldn't have confidence anymore in the system because we beat the system. We destroyed the system. I don't know. We see in the midst of all that, Jamie, we hear people rustling around in the background. There's people saying things in the background, and somebody says something about Con Ed bills. I think Consolidated Edison is the electric company for New York. And so it almost sounds like, do you have like a trader would be on a trading floor, like Con Ed bills, I'm paying, you know, $2 a share for Con Ed bills. Like they wanted they had some sort of a value or something. I didn't figure that out either, what that meant, but somebody was looking for Con Edison bills.
Oh, well, okay. So if you have a breach, like if you have like a loss of data, and you're trying to recover it, it could be that would become a new kind of commodity.
Like you could verify your address or something.
Yeah, like if you have, for example, if it's you know, if it's these power bills, right? And somebody can find them, then it means that you may be able to rebuild, you know, some portion of your lost data, right, for the company, which is going to be completely, I mean, that's like the most valuable thing they have, right? And then also, you may be able to pull other kinds of data from that, like identifying information, whereby you can, you know that this is this specific consumer and they have records, kind of like reconstruct what they lost. And that information in itself could become a tradable commodity, you know, in the absence of having anything else to trade, because I don't know what the, you know, this has, I don't know how this effect has affected the stock market, for example. So, you know, maybe that's something.
Yeah, that's a great take. Cause like if you need a library card or something, they always say, well, just bring in your power bill and we'll confirm your address. Yeah. That's probably exactly what it is. But we see Evil Corp's lawyer and jogging around. She gets back to her apartment, and we see her woes with the controls in her apartment, which I think, interestingly, they somehow hacked through her watch, the Wi-Fi on her watch.
It could have been.
Her app that shows her running and stuff, and it must be somehow connected through. Because didn't they do that with the police car last year somehow? They dropped those USB keys, and they the Bluetooth on the police car, they somehow tapped into the police station.
Okay, so that was like a way lower tech version probably of what they did here. But it's, I think it will probably be something similar, like piggybacking on a piece of access that you can actually get into a deeper access that you couldn't have gotten to otherwise. That may be what they did. And she's got a smart house. I don't know if you heard her talking about that, but that's what that house is. It's wired in a way that all of the access and power and everything, like even just the actual like electrical power access to all of everything in her house is inside the walls.
Yeah.
So she can't access any of that stuff, and it's all connected.
Yeah, it's interesting how they tapped into it, though. Like, they found the weakest spot, and they got into everything. Just kind of like I said with the police car. Yep. Also, Jamie, it was interesting. Outside this lawyer's house on the street was this New York City pile of garbage. I've always been fascinated by garbage in New York City. When you go there, there's garbage freaking everywhere. I mean, that place must generate just heaps and tons of garbage. And there's no space for any of it. I always think, like, how do they process all this stuff? How do they get rid of it all? You know, how does it not just get clogged up and die and, you know, mountains and mountains of garbage block the streets? But they, but it's a functioning system. It's really incredible. It's really amazing.
I never thought about it before. Never thought about it, except to the extent that you hear about how, you know, the Hudson is like really polluted and, you know, stuff like that. And you hear people, you know, tell stories of dumping garbage off the, you know, just right off the coast. I don't know if that ever happens or, you know, or how the garbage is processed, but that is, it's an interesting thought.
Just think how that, you know, how many million people are in New York City, just how much crap they generate every day that has to be flushed out of there. That, I mean, not literally crap, but garbage and throwaway stuff, and you tear open a package. I mean, just, I don't know. It's crazy. Yeah, Jamie, true. Did you know that Mobley had one leg? I think that's Mobley, right?
That is Mobley. And no, I didn't know it. And it was so crazy. Like, that was the wildest thing. I don't know what we missed. Did we miss or forget or something last
or
season?
Never saw? Is that like probably a diabetes thing or something?
Oh, God, I don't know. That's mean, though.
Well, he doesn't look very athletic and healthy.
Yeah, but he doesn't look like a dude who'd have that much diabetes going.
Well, wasn't he super overweight, though?
Yeah, but not like humongo, like, you know, I don't know.
Well, I don't see him in Afghanistan, like, storming a gun post and getting his leg shot off either.
But he could have had, like, cancer or gotten hit by a car or, you know, been born without, like, the bottom part of his leg.
I guess. And who's the woman? At first, I thought that was Darlene, but I'm not sure. Who was that woman going up the stairs?
I thought that was Darlene.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then maybe it is. All right. Elliot meets Gideon now. See, Gideon, there's no more fail-safe. The FBI suspects him for everything. Mr. Robot, I guess, made it look like it was him for everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the way, Jamie, it must be wild to travel everywhere with this entourage that Elliot has, this troop of personalities in his head.
That guy. You know, I wonder about, you know, a person who has that experience, if it's kind of, you know, confusing all the time, which could mean, you know, which could be a reason why he doesn't actually say very much out loud ever on the show.
And we see Mr. Robot cut his throat when he threatens to reveal the secret, which, of course, doesn't really happen because we see something else happen, and maybe that happened instead. I mean, I don't know. Maybe we'll see a third thing later on that shows that that didn't happen. But Mr. Robot cuts his throat. And by the way, Jimmy, why are there two giant monitors in that kitchen? Did you notice that behind them there looked like two monitors in what looked like a kitchen?
I don't know that I couldn't figure out that space. Like, I don't know where that is. Where is Elliot?
I don't know.
Is he at his mom's house?
It's either his mom's house or his house.
It's not his house.
Or it's Gideon's house.
It's got to be his mom's. And so his mom's got to be real. Excuse me. I'm so sorry.
All right. Then there's more journal and dishwashing for sanity. His routine again. He journals and washes the dishes. And then he has lunch with Leon, and Mr. Robot reappears. Next scene, we see F Society celebrating, and Darlene comes up and reminds him that there's more to be done. She smashes the ball cutter guy's phone and says, "We're losing this war."
Did you combine some stuff?
No, I'm just trying to get through it. We jump from Mr. Robot, from Elliot washing the dishes and getting back to his routine, to F Society, where Darlene's kind of up on that upper level.
Right.
And she says,
and then she stops.
She cuts the celebration short by saying, "There's more to be done. Give me that phone." She smashes the phone.
Right. Okay.
And says, "We're losing the war, and Susan Jacobs is the woman we have to worry about because she kills lawsuits that usually involve death. And she's the lawyer that has the crappy apartment with the Internet of Things that's all screwed up."
Right. Okay, yeah. I loved that monologue that Darlene delivered right there. And that was part of what led me to feel like that it's hangover time. She's had her moment of awesome. And, now she's trying to figure out what to do. I think she's one of the only people who feels like, oh, my God, there's so much that we have to get done. And we've lost ground. We're losing ground. We're losing this battle. And, there are things to do. So let's do those things. In the meantime, Elliot is checked out. I don't know what the situation is with the rest of the players. Mr. Robot is powerless right now, literally. And so Darlene is the only one who seems to feel that sense of panic and urgency to take advantage of the opportunity that they've created for themselves.
So Darlene and the IT guy for E Corp talk, and that guy is in the F Society. He's really in both. He's a member of E Corp, but only as a front to get into their system. And she writes a hack for him to put into the E Corp software in their computers. And then we see people at the bank, and there's all kinds of lost payment records, not sure what value is in each account. People have to wait 3 weeks for an appointment to talk to a teller. Just total frustration. Again, this is my blocking the freeway analogy, that it's going to mess up a lot of people that just want to go about their daily lives and have, normal, simple lives. They're victims of this whole thing.
Right. And it's interesting to me that this is probably something that they didn't plan for, because when you think the way that they do, these anarchists, you don't think about the fact that sometimes people, and maybe a lot of the time, people need the structure that is around them, even if it's something that they don't necessarily find easy or pleasant, or that maybe is, largely responsible for a lot of misery in their lives. Sometimes you need things like a record of your payments because it places you in a certain area in your life, that you've paid off your mortgage, that home is actually yours, you own it, that kind of thing, like what this lady was talking about.
Right. So that hack that Darlene has just created appears now on the E Corp computers after the guy plugs it in. And it's the deal is, give us $5.9 million or we turn everything into bricks. We brick all the systems. And then the Evil Corp people discuss it. The lawyer we talked about, the woman, Susan. And then the CEO, what's his name? Philip something? I don't know his last name.
Right. You're talking about the CTO?
Or no, the CTO is Knowles, Scott Knowles.
Right.
The CEO is the guy that picked on Angela way back in the first season. By the way, Jamie, I am against F Society now. I don't like them as much as I liked them originally. I want them to fail.
Okay, they are anarchists. You know, like we have known that, right? From the beginning, we've known that these are people who are bent on the destruction of society. Like that's what they do.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I know there's three sides, though. I mean, I'm against the cops shooting people, and I'm against Black Lives Matter stopping cars on the freeway. I'm against both of those happening. And so I'm against both F Society and Evil Corp in this story. But I'm starting to like hate F Society more than ever because of like this poor lady at the bank waiting in line. And now these people at, I don't know. I just didn't like it. I didn't like how they were so affected by this peripheral collateral damage.
Right. Right. Well, yeah. And okay. So that guy, the guy that you're talking about, the CEO, Philip Price, is that the one you're thinking of?
I guess. I don't know his last name. So. Yeah, the three of them are talking, the lawyer, the CEO, the CTO.
Right, okay, so yeah, it's Philip Price.
They're discussing the demands and how they have to be delivered, and one of the demands is not only the money, but one of the chief officers has to deliver the money.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay, so, all right, so here's the thing. Where you are right now, mentally, like how you're thinking about things that are happening in the real world and juxtaposing that, like your feelings about that with the show, is really, I think that's the whole point, you know, I think that's the whole point because, you know, this thing that they've done is, and let's say it's an anguished cry of the masses, you know, right? That's the way that they are thinking about it, that F Society is thinking about it in a way, right? That they want to wipe out everybody's debt because they hate the system. They hate the, you know, the machine. But it kind of comes down to the conflict that I had last season that we talked about, which is, you know, the name of the group is F Society. It's not F the system. They're anarchists. They're not like against the man and trying to help out, you know, humanity by erasing everyone's debt. That is part of, I guess, a lie, really, that Mr. Robot, you know, told to Elliot to kind of frame this, you know, this anarchy that he wanted to act out. And, you know, the destruction that Darlene wanted to commit. And, you know, Darlene is really idealistic in her thinking, and so it could be that she really doesn't see, you know, that what she's done is hurting the people that she's claiming she wants to help. But Elliot knows. He gets the fact that he's hostile towards society and that this is hurting everyone. He wants to tear down the entire construct. Not just the bad part that's billing people and bankrupting people. He wants to tear down all of society. And so, you know, that's, I mean, what you're feeling is appropriate, you know, because it's like, you know, somebody letting out all the animals in the zoo and you feeling upset, you know, at the zoo animals and at the lack of, you know, control over them.
Yeah, I definitely agree that this is Sam Esmail's comment on society. That's the basis of his story. And it's semi-fictional. It's semi-true. And it's, a lot of it is true. It's interesting. So this part one ends, Jamie, with these demands that these three people at the Evil Corp talking about the demands, and then Knowles offers to be that tough guy. I'll deliver it. If they're asking for our stuff, I want to be the one to see it. So that's where this one kind of ends.
Right.
Interesting, though, too, Jamie, Sam Esmail's company is Esmail Corp. So it's as close to E-Corp as you can get without actually being E-Corp. But at the credits at the end of the episodes, you'll see Esmail Corp. Interestingly. So we get into part two now, and we'll just do that. This is part of our first podcast.
Okay. Wait, do you remember the music from part one? Is that where we had the Phil Collins song? Or was it
No,
later?
That's coming up.
It's coming up. All right. Okay.
Yeah. So this is EPS 2.0_UNM4SK-PT2.TC, episode 2.0, Unmask Part 2. Mm-hmm. And it's Knowles delivering what he wanted to do, be the guy that delivers the money in the two giant bags, the $5.9 million. So he brings the money down to Battery Park, drops it on the ground, and now he's looking very nervous. He's not the ballsy, tough guy that he appeared to be in the office. He's wired and he's asking questions, and there's a guy's watching him and trying to survey the scene, but he's pretty nervous at this point. People are walking around him, and I thought he was going to be attacked for this money, for all this money in his bag. He started taking the money out of the bag and fumbling around with it. I'm like, oh, dude, you're going to get mobbed here. Mm. I was worried about that happening. But that does not happen. A bike delivery messenger brings a knapsack and further instructions for him. And then we start to hear Phil Collins, like you said. And this was a really cool part of this episode, I think. His audio, Phil Collins' audio for Take Me Home, emerges very slowly through this scene as it develops.
Yeah.
Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I thought that was fantastic. And it kind of hit me in a weird way, made me kind of look up and try to figure out what was going on with the soundtrack, because it was a weird choice, a song. Well, it turns out that there are a lot of theories about that song and what it means. And there are some misconceptions about it that are apparently common. And one of those is that the song is about a man returning home, or that it is about the psychological manipulations of the government, like kind of Orwellian kind of stuff, you know, kind of like enslavement of humanity kind of stuff. But there are others who believe that this song, that the lyrics refer to a mental institution, like a mental patient, and that it's a protest song about the way that the UK treats like misfit type people. Apparently, they put them in mental hospitals, and so there are those who say that that's what that song is about.
Yeah,
so
I heard it was based on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Well, there you go.
For the same reasons, yeah. Knowles does show a little courage, though, in opening the bag that gets delivered by the bike messenger. I mean, who knows what's in that damn thing, but he holds it kind of off to the side and opens it and looks in. And then he reads the mask. Back of the mask has instructions, and he gets a phone call, and he has 10 seconds to follow those instructions, which are essentially to burn the money. And the crowd watches as he does this, including Darlene. Darlene's in that crowd watching this happen.
That's right. And the instructions, as the fire gets bigger and glows and the scene closes, we can see that the writing of the instructions are inside. They're written inside the mask.
Right.
Yeah. Burn that money.
Quite a Super Bowl commercial for that $6 million. I wonder what kind of reach that would have had, if it would have had more reach through like YouTube these days, if that were real. Probably would have been pretty spectacular news event.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And that's what Darlene wanted. She didn't care about the money, obviously. She wanted the fear that it would inspire.
Yeah.
All right, so in D.C. now, that guy whose name I forgot.
Hold on a second, Mike. You know, if that's the case, if you're saying that, if that's what you really think that Darlene wants, then that makes her a terrorist.
Yeah, well, that's what I think F Society is, terrorist.
Huh. Interesting.
They're creating terror. They're creating fear. I mean, terrorists, we've taken kind of and foreignized it. Right, it's an outside part of the country, another group outside the U.S. But I think terrorism is just fear, people that want to instigate fear for their own means.
Yeah,
you wouldn't call them a terrorist?
No, I would definitely call Darlene a terrorist, yeah. I definitely would. I hadn't thought about it that way before, though. But yeah, I mean, that's what she is, right?
Yeah, and, you know, they have no borders. They're not national. They're just F society, I guess, in general, because it's a worldwide crisis that's going to happen from this. All right, so down in Washington, that guy, what's his name, Phillip's name?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Price, Phillip Price. Yes, he's right. In D.C. to ask for the government for money to rebuild his database in Evil Core, to recover everything. He's talking to three people, Janet, Mary, and Jack. I don't know who those three people relate to in real life. We see somebody's name, I forget his name now, Leon Panetta, maybe he was a real guy in one of those news stories. But he's talking to these three people, give me money to rebuild my database. And while he's doing that, he picks on, this guy's just an ass, this Price guy. Picks on the guy for having food on his face, like, you've got something there. And the guy's right. Like, oh, I'm glad you finally agree with me. Like, he's like, no, you idiot, you've got something on your mouth.
Right.
So they're worried, the government people are worried the public is hoarding cash. They want him to resign. And then Price relates an FDR tactic to fool the public that happened in the past where the banks were really insolvent, but they wanted to believe that banks were solvent. And the government was under control, even though they weren't, from the Big Depression, Great Depression.
Right.
And so they kind of fudged it back then, and it worked. And Price is actually saying, do this again. Let the people think that they should have confidence in us. And if you don't, if you make me resign, that's going to blow that whole cover.
Yeah.
He's pretty convincing in that argument.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense if you're going to, you know, I mean, if you're in that circumstance, what do you do? Which, by the way, we missed a major piece here. I don't know if you skipped it on purpose to talk about it later or what happened, but we missed Gideon, the finish of things for Gideon.
No, it's coming up. Jamie, do you realize that every single time you say that, it's coming up? It's yet to be spoken about.
Okay, but I don't know why it's yet to be spoken about, because that happens before the scene in the park.
I'm just scrolling ahead in my notes. No, it's coming up.
Well, then I don't know what the deal is. I think your stuff is out of order, Mike.
Are you talking about the guy that tries to pick him up in the bar and then that event happens? Guy flirts with him a little bit. Yeah, that's coming up. It's near the very end of part two.
What? Oh, I don't know.
Let's just go through it. We'll get to it.
All right.
All right. So now I got to go find where I was. Thank you, Jamie.
You're welcome.
All right. So this struggle about confidence is parallel, I think, to Elliot's struggle to maintain control. He needs a routine so he can keep control and confidence of himself and remain calm and in control. Even if it's pretend. It's like pretend I'm going to wash the dishes. I'm going to go to the park. I'm going to eat lunch with Leon. It's kind of a routine that just keeps the confusion at bay.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's Price's argument. If I resign, the whole con goes away and everything falls to pieces. All right, Jamie, we get reintroduced now to Wellick's crazy wife, Joanne, and her bondage play. She's looking very unpregnant now. She's back in shape.
Right. Joanna.
Is it Joanna?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. And she's doing some bondage and knife play with this new boy toy who ends up slapping her and punching her around. Pretty crazy stuff, huh?
Yeah.
Is there any symbolism to that you've figured out? That why does she has all this snooty power, but she wants to be dominated?
I don't know. You know, stuff like that, sometimes it has a meaning. And I think most of the time, whenever you have like weird, kinky sex stuff going on, it's not anything. Like, it's just to keep people either thinking or talking about whatever it is.
So it's like the tits and dragons. It keeps people coming back to the show because they might catch a snippet of sexy stuff.
Yeah, just stupid.
It is a power move, though. I mean, she needs to feel underpowered and overpowered by somebody else to get sexual pleasure from it. And then it's all false. Like 10 minutes later, she's like, you're dismissed. Go away. I don't want you here anymore.
Yeah, right.
It is false, but it is somehow meaningful to her.
I guess. I don't know. I don't, she's weird.
All right, Jamie, let's go to Ahmed's coffee shop, where a redhead is talking to Ahmed, the coffee shop owner. And I think her name is Dominique.
Let's see. What is her name? Yes, it's Dominique DiPiero. And that's Grace Gummer, by the way, who's playing that part. And she is Meryl Streep's daughter.
Yeah, that's cool. Interesting that we meet a character named Dominique right on the heels of this BDSM sex play between these two, between Joanna and the boy toy. But anyway, she's talking to this shop owner.
Wait, hold on a minute. What does that mean?
Because dominating, Dominique, dominate.
Oh, okay. All right. I got you.
And she speaks Farsi to this guy. This is an Iranian guy, I think, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and she's ordering coffee and a sandwich. And she's talking to him while there's a line building up behind her. Jamie, this makes me mad in real life, too. I do not like people that small talk while there's a line behind them. And I'm in that line.
Okay. I don't know. I don't pay attention to stuff like that.
Well, you're just nicer than me and easygoing. That makes me mad.
Sorry, Mike.
So this redhead is at what, the FBI, I guess?
Uh-huh.
She goes back to work, and they talk to Gideon in the cell in the interview room at the FBI. All right, Jamie, now here's where it gets complicated, or it could be just Reddit, but here's the Reddit theory. So it's the basketball game. And the Reddit theory, have you heard of this or read any of this theory?
No.
The Reddit theory is that this is prison, that Elliot is in prison. He's in prison since the end of season one. If you think about it, his room looks like a prison cell. And then the Reddit theory continues that Ray is the prison guard or a prison psychologist, but a prison employee. And that Leon is a fellow inmate because he watches TV all the time. That's all he can talk about. And they're playing basketball in the courtyard. I mean, there's a lot of prison-y type things happening here with this basketball game.
Hmm.
But anyway, but back to the real scene we see. Leon and Elliot are watching this game, and the ball rolls right up to Leon, and he tosses the ball away. And then Ray, this guy Ray and his dog Maxine walk up, and they kind of save it from becoming a big fight.
Right.
And Ray says that Maxine likes Elliot. And then Ray continues to talk that this game, this basketball game, has like three planes of perspectives in it. The player's perspective, the watchers of the game's perspective, and Maxine's perspective. I really like this review of the game by Ray. And all those different perspectives had different levels of meaning. And some of those perspectives faked confidence to try to dominate others in the situation. Like the players were all hard asses. Like, hey, I'm a better baller than you, or give me that ball or kick your ass. It's all faking of confidence for something that doesn't really have any importance at all. Mm. And you could almost attach some of that to like a prison yard, I think, like an institutionalized group of dudes playing basketball, because they weren't very good basketball players. It was just a pickup game. It was just a time filling event of playing basketball. I don't know. Do you buy into any of that? That there might be a situation where Elliot's in jail?
Well, okay. So I can see why they might reason that. I don't know that I buy it.
Okay. Or it might be Elliot projecting what jail might be like.
Well, I would be more likely to believe that it would be the writer or writers saying to the audience, you know, giving us all of that context to make us feel like Elliot feels like his life is kind of confining in like a prison. Like that I totally buy, but I don't know.
Because otherwise, why would this guy Ray want to connect with Elliot?
Well, he's hanging out in the neighborhood, right? And then we get a little bit of information because Ray is trying to talk to Elliot. He's trying to, you know, he's getting, he's going, he's approaching that place of, he wants to ask him for something. And Elliot cuts him off and he's like, "Not, dude, I don't know what you heard. What you heard is wrong. I'm not into that stuff anymore." So whatever it is that Ray wanted, you know, that's what he was doing. He was trying to approach Elliot to ask him for some help or for some work or something. And Elliot let him know, don't even try, because I'm not doing that anymore.
Okay. So Elliot walks home to wherever that is, his cell or his apartment or his mom's house. Okay. And he reminds us that without any hardware, Mr. Robot is at bay. And we see on the news, everyone's looking for Wellick now. He's somehow out of the picture. He's either dead or hiding or just not in the picture. And the boy toy and the wife, Joanna, talk. Or he tries to talk to her while she's taking a bath. And the bodyguard, she makes the bodyguard. She just tells him to leave. The bodyguard tells her she's late. She needs to get going. And she kicks him out. Mm-hmm. So we see a total flip of the whole power situation then there between those two.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So, but even when she was tied up, though, she was the one who was in control. It's, you know, it's, I think that those kinds of relationships are never what they seem to be on the surface when you look at them.
So we jump to the Evil Corp offices, and Angela is at her job in PR. She's the head of PR now. And right. We see that she has all these affirmations around her cubicle. She's totally into, like, boosting herself up. Again, confidence plays, you know, through almost every thread of every scene in this episode. And she's trying to make a deal with the Bloomberg News Network for an exclusive. And she's playing tough with the Bloomberg people and really with her coworkers. We find that her coworkers don't like Angela at all. They're making fun of her, being really snippy with her. And they actually don't trust her skills as this PR director and call in a superior. Because they think she's going to blow the whole thing with Bloomberg.
Oh, is that what you took? I didn't take that from that.
Yeah, well, how did you see it?
Well, I mean, not... I wouldn't say there was anything, you know, special that I took anything in particular from the scene. I just didn't take all that you took from it. Like, that kind of washed over me. I didn't get any of that.
Well, the very beginning of the scene, the woman receptionist at the front is saying, oh, I don't like her. Nobody likes her. She's like talking about Angela, about how the office does not like her.
Oh, I didn't remember hearing any of that.
And then she literally has those affirmation little posters all posted on the walls of her cubicle. And she's on the phone with Bloomberg and CNN and Fox and, you know, the networks, and she's dissing everyone but Bloomberg, but she's telling Bloomberg, I'm not going to do it that way, even though that's the one she wants. She's saying, no, that's too many questions. I want one question. I'll agree to one question. No okay. Suicide talk about Pluff. I don't even remember Pluff and the suicide with Pluff. Do you remember that?
Okay, so there was a guy who went out and committed suicide, like in the sight of the TV cameras last season after this whole thing went down.
Oh, right.
That's the one she's talking about. But I looked at my notes, and I see what you're talking about with Angela. It looks like that somebody they resent her because they don't know why she's there. They think she came out of nowhere. Like that she got that position out of the clear blue.
Yeah, she got fast tracked by Price.
Yeah, so that's what their problem is. And yeah, and I see what you're saying. They're saying somebody hates her too. So like, yeah. So
she's talking on the phone to Bloomberg while this woman's listening to her, and she's like, did you just hang up on Bloomberg? I'm gonna go tell whoever. She names some lady who's the superior, and Angela's like, fuck you, get out of my cubicle and go get her if you want to get her, but just get the fuck away from me. She's really like confident even if she's faking it. And when that woman comes back with the superior, the phone rings and it's Bloomberg, and they agree to all of Angela's terms. Right. So Angela playing hardball totally works, and she kind of shows the upstages this stupid woman going to get the superior. Like, Angela's going to blow it, but right, Angela so, gets it.
Yeah, and you know, that kind of stuff is kind of fascinating to me right now. Just like in a personal sense, I can kind of identify with Angela a little bit, even though like everybody's hating on her, because I've had an experience like that in my personal life where, like on a much tinier scale, where I've had to kind of play hardball in order to get something that I thought I should have, and it totally worked.
Oh, Jamie, do your office workers hate you?
No. No, actually, my office workers don't.
I know. I'm teasing you. I'm glad you're kicking ass, though.
Yeah, I mean, and that's hard to do sometimes. And I like that because, you know, like last season, Angela was not that kind of person. She had to learn how to be that kind of person.
She's still not that kind of person. She's kind of faking it with the confidence thing.
Yeah, but you have to do that. You know, it's so funny you brought that up because I was talking to somebody this week about politics, of course. And I remember years and years and years ago, like a long time ago, I didn't like Hillary Clinton at all. Like, I couldn't stand her. And I used this thing she used to say as my reason for hating her. She said this thing once. She said she believed in the idea of fake it till you make it. And I thought that was just the most odious thing I'd ever heard because it sounds so insincere, right? But I didn't get it. I didn't get that sometimes, like, in life and in business, you have to do that because you may be called upon to be a person that you're not at that point. And you don't have a choice sometimes. You have to fake it till you make it. And
yeah, I absolutely agree with that philosophy.
Right. Okay. So, you know, it took me years to actually understand that. Excuse me, my
Come on, Jamie, fake it to make it. You have no cough in your throat.
All right. So that is what Angela is doing. And so that's, I think it's really cool, really interesting.
So we see Joanna now with the baby in the baby carriage walking around the streets. They see a box, a gift box with a phone attached underneath it. I think it's a music box, we find out later.
Right, on the doorstep.
And a phone underneath it. Mm-hmm. We go to a scene with Angela in the bar. She meets the lawyer lady that tried to help her. I like this kind of distraught lawyer lady. She's kind of beaten down and she's not as successful as the other lawyer, and she's kind of a smart she's like an underdog lawyer. I like this woman. I like this lawyer. She goes to the bar to meet Angela. Angela tells her she's decided to keep the job without even discussing it with the lawyer, which they had kind of agreed to do. And then the lawyer, Skylar, wipes the glass of wine down.
Right.
She's kind of like, well, screw you then, baby, because we were going to talk about this, and now you're just doing what you want to do, and she powers down that glass of wine. Angela reasserts her value, like she's faking it till she makes it here, even. And she says, they see my value, you know, they meaning Evil Corp.
Right. So the attorney, that's the actress. The attorney is Antara Nayar, and the actress is Sakina Jaffrey. And she's fantastic. Like, I really like her. You and I both liked her so much last season. I can remember us talking about her and how, I mean, even just the whole thing of, like, the drinking. They were drinking in her office. They were drinking out of coffee mugs. It was just like this weird, you know, thing that just seemed so real. And she brings such a reality to that role and to the show. I think she's great. And she's been in a couple of things. Like, she was in House of Cards a little bit and the Mindy Project. And I really like her here.
Actually looks like the... I made a joke about Skylar's wine drinking. She actually looks like the lawyer. Remember when Skylar went to a lawyer in Breaking Bad?
She does kind of look like her.
I wonder if it's the same person, but if not, she looks like that. She's like not really totally pretty, but she's very capable and very, very sincere. She really, you could tell she really wants the best for Angela.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just interesting.
Yeah, she's great. That lady, the lady who played the lawyer, Skylar's lawyer in Breaking Bad, was the wife of somebody who worked on the show. And she was I don't think she was like specifically an actress. I think they just put her in the role because they thought she could do it.
She was good in that role, yeah.
Yeah, she was good.
So then this lawyer gives, what's the lawyer's name in the show?
Give me a second, I gotta go back to her. I think it's Lee Nayar or something like that. Hold on a second.
She gives the $1 million.
Antara Nayar. Is her name.
She gives the $1 million joke.
Right.
That was pretty funny.
I liked it. I thought it was appropriate because, you know, as much as I liked, like, some of the stuff that, what's her name? I'm sorry. Angela did this episode, I don't like Angela very much. I have a hard time with her.
She's turned rotten. She's just, she's becoming evil. She's becoming part of the evil corp, company profile.
All right, Mike. So that's my question about this scene with Angela. I got to ask you, like, what's your take on it? Do you think that there's something more, you know, beyond what we're seeing with her right now? Or do you think that this is it? I mean, like, she has turned into what she personally despises.
Yeah, she's fulfilling her potential, even if it's, like, kind of nasty. It's kind of like Walter White. She's sucking up this power. It's fuel for her. It's like dope. She likes it. She likes the feeling of the power that she's achieved and that she's being, that's being deemed to her by others around her. She likes, it's intoxicating to her, I think.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way, because I did not want to believe that. I thought last season that there was something beyond that. There was something, under the surface with her that we would see later that would, reveal that, her goodness and, the goal that she set out, that she had in mind, was true and intact and, and that.
Yeah, I'm doing this for my father. And
yeah.
I don't think so. I think they hammer this point home by the very next thing that happens. She picks up the guy in the bar and takes him home.
Yeah.
And just for a superficial, meaningless, wow, this is pleasure. This is me observing the power that I have, and I'm going to, revel in its rewards. Mm. I don't know. I just think she's turning kind of evil. And she, after sleeping with this guy, practices her affirmations.
Yeah, which was crazy. I mean, I don't know. It could be, complex. It could be that she just doesn't know who she is, and that you're right. She's been seduced by this whole thing, and I don't know. It's kind of, it's interesting. That's for sure.
So more basketball with Ray. Ray comes up again, and Elliot rejects him again. And Ray indicates that they had spoken the night before, but Elliot doesn't remember.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So what's the deal with that?
So he runs home to check his notes, and he sees the sleep time, we went to sleep, the wake-up time, and the gap in between. And he realizes that probably Mr. Robot had spoken to Ray.
Yeah.
And Mr. Robot tells him, they see me. They don't see you.
Yep.
And Elliot starts to laugh kind of maniacally.
Yeah.
So it kind of leaves you with the feeling that the only way to ever stop Mr. Robot is for Elliot to kill himself.
Or for Elliot to actually destroy Mr. Robot. Maybe, maybe there's a way for that. But I don't know if that's something we should care about as the audience, And this space right now where the show is has me really uncomfortable. Because it's not clean. I mean, there's no clean way to understand.
Yeah, it's hard to get your footing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not a very reliable narrator because he doesn't even know what he's doing.
Right.
He asks again. Oh, he asks Mr. Robot again about Terrell. Where is he? Mm-hmm. And says the only one he's going to drive mad is you, not me. So Elliot says that to Mr. Robot. The only one he's going to drive mad is you, not me. I think I remember that right. Like, that's the way it comes out. Elliot to Mr. Robot. And then it goes to the church group. The church group was another part of potentially it being a prison. Like, you have a meeting every so often at the prison.
Okay.
But Elliot goes to this church group, and they talk. He's falling asleep in the group.
Right.
The next scene is at a bar, and it's news talking about the burning money episode with Price.
Right. So he's lost time there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So this is the scene with Gideon. So Gideon's at that bar, and a guy's watching the TV and the news report, and the guy flirts with him, tries to pick him up, and apparently not, because he ends up shooting him. But he relates during this conversation with this guy, they talk about all the hacks and the monetary crash and what the hacks have done to affect society. And this guy says, tomorrow I'll be a hero. Boom, shoots him, like, it looks like in the throat.
Yeah, it shot him in the throat, like right in the jugular.
And it looks like that's it for Gideon.
Yeah.
Because that's us viewing that. That's not Mr. Robot viewing that.
Yeah. I screamed when it happened. It's awful.
All right, Joanne listens to the music box while she's watching the baby on the monitor, and the baby needs attention, so she goes away. And while she's away, the phone, the secret phone on the bottom of the box, calls or rings. She misses that call.
Yep.
And we don't know who that is, although we can guess who it is.
Yeah, so we think it's Terrell, right?
I actually never thought it was Terrell. I thought it was maybe Elliot on that red phone.
Oh.
Because that red phone rings and nobody answers it.
Okay, so we can objectively know that Tyrell is not Elliot, right? Because we saw his picture on news reports and that they think that he's the one and everyone's looking for him and can't find him. And Elliot's walking around in the broad daylight, at least according to our perception of things. And so we know that Elliot is not Tyrell, right?
Well, I guess. I mean, we have to believe some stuff that we see.
Right.
There has to be a little cement in this shifting sand.
Okay, so there's something that, before we wrap up everything, there's something that we didn't talk about. There was a, in the first half of this episode.
Well, let's just finish this off. So the girl looks at the music box and the baby and the phone rings. She doesn't know who it is. The church, back of the church group, it's where Elliot's asleep. The leader of the group saying, "I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end," reading some sort of scripture or some sort of a, I don't know where that's from actually, but it sounds like religious.
Yeah. I think this is, the Bible, I think. And I'm going to look some of it up to just to make sure. But yeah, I can read it.
Then Elliot makes that call on the red phone, which again might be prison-y, although I don't know if they have red phones with old-looking phones like that in prisons. But it's very staticky on the line, and then he says, "Is it really you? Bonsoir, Elliot." And then that's the end of the part two episode.
Yeah. So I did some searching for the words that are in that thing.
Are you going to give it to us in the Southern Baptist preacher voice?
I don't think it's from the Bible because I can't find it. I think this was just written actually for the show. But yeah, I can give it to you. No, actually, I can't give it to you in Southern Baptist. But
I was going to give you an amen, Jamie.
That would be crazy. If I drank alcohol, I would be happy to do that for you.
If I drank alcohol.
And there shall be no more death. Right here.
Revelation 12, verse 13. I am the Alpha and Omega, the first and the last. Is from Revelation.
Is? Could not find it on the internet. All right. So, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, "Behold, I will make all things new." And he said unto me, "Write, for these words are true and faithful." And he said unto me, "It is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is what? A thirst of the fountain of the water of life freely, that he that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son." So,
essentially, I'll give to each person according to what they've done. So it's like if you attach that to the show, it's like a CEO making 10,000 times what the average worker in the company makes. You know, maybe it's not fair. So maybe that's the meaning. It's like, I'll give you what you actually do, you'll get value for.
Fascinating.
I don't know. That's me just totally bluffly reading into that. But that's part of that verse, though. To give unto each person according to what he has done.
Yeah, that's very communist. Oh, no, it's not. It's very, like, capitalist.
Yeah.
It's like the opposite. Okay, so, all right. There was one thing we missed, and that was in the beginning. I think it was in part one. Elliot is in his journal. And on one of the pages, like opposite the page he's writing on, there's a QR code. Did you see that?
It's yeah, like, that was weird. What was that?
Well, it leads to this freaky, weird website. ConfictureIndustries.com, and it's this weird old web looking stuff that's got like this real kind of like old timey graphics and stuff. And it just says, welcome to Confectura Industries on the World Wide Web. It's got like just weird graphics, and it says under construction. And then it says this website has been optimized for Netscape now, like Netscape 3.0.
So you scanned it with your phone or something and it brought you to that website?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So it's a really cool thing. I'm going to put it up on my website because I actually did build the website that I said I was going to do. We talked about it on an update thing for the Americans, an update episode for our podcast. And I said that I was going to name it Things I Wish I'd Said. Well, or something like that. But when I went to get the domain, I couldn't get anything. Like, there was nothing available. So I named it Wish I Said That Shit. So it really is. It's wishisaidthatshit.com. And it's a blog, and it's going to have notes and thoughts and things about all of our podcasts, the things that occur to me after we record, because it happens every single time. I always have second thoughts. And so whenever I have thoughts and links and things like that, I will post them to that website, and it'll all link back to you at West Coast Project and at Scathing Tweets. And so hopefully it'll be a little link in the chain.
So, Jamie, what you're saying is you want a second chance.
That's correct.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes for awesome. This episode of season 2, episode 1 of Mr. Robot. Had two parts. We did them both. And next episode will be season 2, episode 2, which we're late on already. And we've got episode 3 right around the corner. So we're still kind of hammering out our schedule for this.
Yeah, so yeah, we'll figure it out and we'll get on track and we'll have everybody's episodes when they want to end them and expect them. And so hopefully everything will all be working in concert.
So Jamie, how do people reach you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter and I'm at WordGirly, and I also have my my website, and we just pumped it. So you're on Twitter too.
At Scathing Tweets, and of course West Coast Project for all of our other episodes and our other catalog of shows. Check us out. Look us up on Facebook. And best of all, if you can, like us on iTunes. It gets us a lot more traffic.
Yeah, that really means a lot. Like, getting us up in the ranks on iTunes. If you guys just, like, give us a quick rating. Positive rating's always good, but we'll take what we can get. You know, give us a rating on iTunes and come and visit our websites. But especially iTunes is great. It would get us out there and get us more visible and get you guys more of what you want.
All right, Jamie. Great getting back on the podcast horse again with you.
Awesome. Good to talk to you, Mike.
All right. See you next week.
Bye.